Chapter 97. The Hashashin smiled as he pulled his van into the mammoth stone structure overlooking the Tiber River. He carried his prize up and up, spiraling higher in the stone tunnel, grateful his load was slender. He arrived at the door. "The Church of Illumination," he gloated. "The ancient Illuminati meeting room. Who would have imagined it to be here?" Inside, he placed her on a plush divan. Then he expertly bound her arms behind her back and tied her feet. He knew that what he longed for would have to wait until his final task was finished. Water. Still, he thought, he had a moment for indulgence. Kneeling beside her, he ran his hand along her thigh. It was smooth. Higher. His dark fingers snaked beneath the cuff of her shorts. Higher. He stopped. "Patience," he told himself, feeling aroused. "There is work to be done." He walked for a moment out onto the chamber's high stone balcony. The evening breeze slowly cooled his ardor. Far below, the Tiber raged. He raised his eyes to the dome of St. Peter's, three-quarters of a mile away, naked under the glare of the hundreds of press lights. "Your final hour," he said aloud, picturing the thousands of Muslims slaughtered during the Crusades. "At midnight you will meet your God." Behind him the woman stirred. The Hashashin turned. He considered letting her wake up. Seeing terror in a woman's eyes was his ultimate aphrodisiac. He opted for prudence. It would be better if she remained unconscious while he was gone. Although she was tied and would never escape, the Hashashin didn't want to return and find her exhausted from struggling. "I want your strength preserved. For me." Lifting her head slightly, he placed his palm beneath her neck and found the hollow directly beneath her skull. The crown meridian pressure point was the one he had used countless times. With crushing force, he drove his thumb into the soft cartilage and felt it depress. The woman slumped instantly. 20 minutes, he thought. She would be a tantalizing end to a perfect day. After she had served him and died doing it, he would stand on the balcony and watch the midnight Vatican fireworks. Leaving his prize unconscious on the couch, the Hashashin went downstairs into a torchlit dungeon. The final task. He walked to the table and revered the sacred metal forms that had been left there for him. Water. It was his last. Removing a torch from the wall, as he had done 3 times already, he began heating the end. When the end of the object was white hot, he carried it to the cell. Inside, a single man stood in silence, old and alone. "Cardinal Baja," the killer hissed. "Have you prayed yet?" The Italian's eyes were fearless. "Only for your soul." Chapter 98. The 6 Pompieri firemen who responded to the fire at the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria extinguished the bonfire with blasts of halon gas. Water was cheaper, but the steam it created would have ruined the frescoes in the chapel. And the Vatican paid Roman Pompieri a healthy stipend for swift and prudent service in all Vatican-owned buildings. Pompieri, by the nature of their work, witnessed tragedy almost daily. But the execution in this church was something none of them would ever forget. Part crucifixion, part hanging, part burning at the stake. The scene was something dredged from a Gothic nightmare. Unfortunately, the press, as usual, had arrived before the fire department. They'd shot plenty of video before the Pompieri cleared the church. When the firemen finally cut the victim down and laid him on the floor, there was no doubt who the man was. "Cardinale Guidera," one whispered. "Di Barcelona." The victim was nude. The lower half of his body was crimson-black, blood oozing through gaping cracks in his thighs. His shin bones were exposed. One fireman vomited. Another went outside to breathe. The true horror, though, was the symbol seared on the cardinal's chest. The squad chief circled the corpse in awestruck dread. "Lavoro del diavolo," he said to himself. "Satan himself did this." He crossed himself for the first time since childhood. "Un altro corpo," someone yelled. One of the firemen had found another body. The second victim was a man the chief recognized immediately. The austere commander of the Swiss Guard was a man for whom few public law enforcement officials had any affection. The chief called the Vatican, but all the circuits were busy. He knew it didn't matter. The Swiss Guard would hear about this on television in a matter of minutes. As the chief surveyed the damage, trying to recreate what possibly could have gone on here, he saw a niche riddled with bullet holes. A coffin had been rolled off its supports and fallen upside down in an apparent struggle. It was a mess. "That's for the police and Holy See to deal with," the chief thought, turning away. As he turned, though, he stopped. Coming from the coffin, he heard a sound. It was not a sound any fireman ever liked to hear. "Bomba!" he cried out. "Tutti fuori!" When the bomb squad rolled the coffin over, they discovered the source of the electronic beeping. They stared, confused. "Medico!" one finally screamed. "Medico!" Chapter 99. "Any word from Olivetti?" the Camerlengo asked, looking drained as Rocher escorted him back from the Sistine Chapel to the Pope's office. "No, signore. I'm feeling the worst." When they reached the Pope's office, the Camerlengo's voice was heavy. "Captain, there is nothing more I can do here tonight. I fear I have done too much already. I am going into this office to pray. I do not wish to be disturbed. The rest is in God's hands." "Yes, signore." "The hour is late, Captain. Find that canister." "Our search continues," Rocher hesitated. "The weapon proves to be too well hidden." The Camerlengo winced, as if he could not think of it. "Yes. At exactly 11:15 p.m., if the church is still in peril, I want you to evacuate the cardinals. I am putting their safety in your hands. I ask only one thing. Let these men proceed from this place with dignity. Let them exit into St. Peter's Square and stand side by side with the rest of the world. I do not want the last image of this church to be frightened old men sneaking out a back door." "Very good, signore. And you? Shall I come for you at 11:15 as well?" "There will be no need." "Signore?" "I will leave when the spirit moves me." Rocher wondered if the Camerlengo intended to go down with the ship. The Camerlengo opened the door to the Pope's office and entered. "Actually," he said, turning, "there is one thing. Signore, there seems to be a chill in this office tonight. I am trembling." "The electric heat is out. Let me lay you a fire." The Camerlengo smiled tiredly. "Thank you. Thank you very much." Rocher exited the Pope's office, where he had left the Camerlengo praying by firelight in front of a small statue of the Blessed Mother Mary. It was an eerie sight, a black shadow kneeling in the flickering glow. As Rocher headed down the hall, a guard appeared, running toward him. Even by candlelight, Rocher recognized Lieutenant Chartrand, young, green, and eager. "Captain," Chartrand called, holding out a cellular phone. "I think the Camerlengo's address may have worked. We've got a caller here who says he has information that can help us. He phoned on one of the Vatican's private extensions. I have no idea how he got the number." Rocher stopped. "What?" He will only speak to the ranking officer. Any word from Olivetti?
No, sir.
He took the receiver. This is Captain Rocher. I am ranking officer here. The voice said, Rocher, I will explain to you who I am, then I will tell you what you are going to do next. When the caller stopped talking and hung up, Rocher stood stunned. He now knew from whom he was taking orders. Back at CERN, Sylvie Badaloc was frantically trying to keep track of all the licensing inquiries coming in on Kohler's voicemail. When the private line on the director's desk began to ring, Sylvie jumped. Nobody had that number. She answered,
Yes?
Miss Badaloc, this is Director Kohler. Contact my pilot. My jet is to be ready in 5 minutes.
Chapter 100. Robert Langdon had no idea where he was or how long he had been unconscious when he opened his eyes and found himself staring up at the underside of a Baroque frescoed cupola. Smoke drifted overhead. Something was covering his mouth. An oxygen mask. He pulled it off. There was a terrible smell in the room, like burning flesh. Langdon winced at the pounding in his head. He tried to sit up. A man in white was kneeling beside him.
Riposati,
the man said, easing Langdon onto his back again.
Sono il paramedico.
Langdon succumbed, his head spiraling like the smoke overhead. What the hell happened? Wispy feelings of panic sifted through his mind.
Sorcio Salvatore, the paramedic said. Mouse, savior.
Langdon felt even more lost.
Mouse, savior?
The man motioned to the Mickey Mouse watch on Langdon's wrist. Langdon's thoughts began to clear. He remembered setting the alarm. As he stared absently at the watch face, Langdon also noted the hour. 10:28 p.m. He sat bolt upright. Then it all came back. Langdon stood near the main altar with the fire chief and a few of his men. They had been rattling him with questions. Langdon wasn't listening. He had questions of his own. His whole body ached, but he knew he needed to act immediately. A pompiero approached Langdon across the church.
I checked again, sir. The only bodies we found are Cardinal Guidera and the Swiss Guard commander. There's no sign of a woman here.
Grazie, Langdon said, unsure whether he was relieved or horrified. He knew he had seen Vittoria unconscious on the floor. Now she was gone. The only explanation he came up with was not a comforting one. The killer had not been subtle on the phone.
A woman of spirit, I am aroused. Perhaps before this night is over, I will find you, and when I do...
Langdon looked around.
Where is the Swiss Guard?
Still no contact. Vatican lines are jammed. Langdon felt overwhelmed and alone. Olivetti was dead. The Cardinal was dead. Vittoria was missing. A half hour of his life had disappeared in a blink. Outside, Langdon could hear the press swarming. He suspected footage of the third cardinal's horrific death would no doubt air soon, if it hadn't already. Langdon hoped the Camerlengo had long since assumed the worst and taken action.
Evacuate the damn Vatican. Enough games. We lose.
Langdon suddenly realized that all of the catalysts that had been driving him, helping to save Vatican City, rescuing the four cardinals, coming face to face with the brotherhood he had studied for years, all of these things had evaporated from his mind. The war was lost. A new compulsion had ignited within him. It was simple, stark, primal. Find Vittoria. He felt an unexpected emptiness inside. Langdon had often heard that intense situations could unite two people in ways that decades together often did not. He now believed it. In Vittoria's absence, he felt something he had not felt in years. Loneliness. The pain gave him strength. Pushing all else from his mind, Langdon mustered his concentration. He prayed that the Hashashin would take care of business before pleasure. Otherwise, Langdon knew he was already too late.
No, he told himself. You have time. Vittoria's captor still had work to do. He had to surface one last time before disappearing forever. The last altar of science, Langdon thought. The killer had one final task. Earth, air, fire, water. He looked at his watch. 30 minutes. Langdon moved past the fireman toward Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa. This time, as he stared at Bernini's marker, Langdon had no doubt what he was looking for. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Directly over the recumbent saint, against a backdrop of gilded flame, hovered Bernini's angel. The angel's hand clutched a pointed spear of fire. Langdon's eyes followed the direction of the shaft, arcing toward the right side of the church. His eyes hit the wall. He scanned the spot where the spear was pointing. There was nothing there. Langdon knew, of course, the spear was pointing far beyond the wall, into the night, somewhere across Rome. "What direction is that?" Langdon asked, turning and addressing the chief with a newfound determination. "Direction?" The chief glanced where Langdon was pointing. He sounded confused.
"I don't know. West, I think."
"What churches are in that direction?"
The chief's puzzlement seemed to deepen.
"Dozens. Why?"
Langdon frowned. Of course there were dozens.
"I need a city map right away."
The chief sent someone running out to the fire truck for a map. Langdon turned back to the statue.
Earth, air, fire, Vittoria.
The final marker is water, he told himself. Bernini's water. It was in a church out there somewhere. A needle in a haystack. He spurred his mind through all the Bernini works he could recall. I need a tribute to water.
Langdon flashed on Bernini's statue of Triton, the Greek god of the sea. Then he realized it was located in the square outside this very church, in entirely the wrong direction. He forced himself to think. What figure would Bernini have carved as a glorification of water? Neptune and Apollo? Unfortunately, that statue was in London's Victoria and Albert Museum.
Signore?
A fireman ran in with a map. Langdon thanked him and spread it out on the altar. He immediately realized he had asked the right people. The fire department's map of Rome was as detailed as any Langdon had ever seen.
Where are we now?
The man pointed.
Next to Piazza Barberini.
Langdon looked at the angel's spear again to get his bearings. The chief had estimated correctly. According to the map, the spear was pointing west. Langdon traced a line from his current location west across the map. Almost instantly, his hopes began to sink. It seemed that with every inch his finger traveled, he passed yet another building marked with a tiny black cross.
Churches! The city was riddled with them!
Finally, Langdon's finger ran out of churches and trailed off into the suburbs of Rome. He exhaled and stepped back from the map.
Damn!
Surveying the whole of Rome, Langdon's eyes touched down on the three churches where the first three cardinals had been killed. The Chigi Chapel, St. Peter's, here. Seeing them all laid out before him now, Langdon noted an oddity in their locations. Somehow he had imagined the churches would be scattered randomly across Rome, but they most definitely weren't. Improbably, the three churches seemed to be separated systematically in an enormous citywide triangle. Langdon double-checked. He wasn't imagining things.
"Penna,"
he said suddenly, without looking up. Someone handed him a ballpoint pen. Langdon circled the three churches. His pulse quickened. He triple-checked his markings. A symmetrical triangle. Langdon's first thought was for the great seal on the $1 bill, the triangle containing the all-seeing eye. But it didn't make sense. He had only marked three points. There were supposed to be four in all.
So where the hell is water?
Langdon knew that anywhere he placed the fourth point, the triangle would be destroyed. The only option to retain the symmetry was to place the fourth marker inside the triangle, at the center. He looked at the spot on the map. Nothing. The idea bothered him anyway. The four elements of science were considered equal. Water was not special. Water would not be at the center of the others. Still, his instinct told him the systematic arrangement could not possibly be accidental. I'm not yet seeing the whole picture. There was only one alternative. The four points did not make a triangle. They made some other shape. Langdon looked at the map. A square, perhaps? Although a square made no symbolic sense, squares were symmetrical, at least. Langdon put his finger on the map at one of the points that would turn the triangle into a square. He saw immediately that a perfect square was impossible. The angles of the original triangle were oblique and created more of a distorted quadrilateral. As he studied the other possible points around the triangle, something unexpected happened. He noticed that the line he had drawn earlier to indicate the direction of the angel's spear passed perfectly through one of the possibilities. Stupefied, Langdon circled that point. He was now looking at four ink marks on the map, arranged in somewhat of an awkward kite-like diamond. He frowned. Diamonds were not an Illuminati symbol, either. He paused. Then again. For an instant, Langdon flashed on the famed Illuminati diamond. The thought, of course, was ridiculous. He dismissed it. Besides, this diamond was oblong, like a kite. Hardly an example of the flawless symmetry for which the Illuminati diamond was revered. When he leaned in to examine where he had placed the final mark, Langdon was surprised to find that the fourth point lay dead center of Rome's famed Piazza Navona. He knew the piazza contained a major church, but he had already traced his finger through that piazza and considered the church there. To the best of his knowledge, it contained no Bernini works. The church was called St. Agnes in Agony, named for St. Agnes, a ravishing teenage virgin banished to a life of sexual slavery for refusing to renounce her faith. There must be something in that church. Langdon racked his brain, picturing the inside of the church. He could think of no Bernini works at all inside, much less anything to do with water. The arrangement on the map was bothering him, too. A diamond. It was far too accurate to be coincidence, but it was not accurate enough to make any sense. A kite? Langdon wondered if he had chosen the wrong point. What am I missing? The answer took another 30 seconds to hit him. But when it did, Langdon felt an exhilaration like nothing he had ever experienced in his academic career. The Illuminati genius, it seemed, would never cease. The shape he was looking at was not intended as a diamond at all. The four points only formed a diamond, because Langdon had connected the adjacent points. The Illuminati believe in opposites. Connecting opposite vertices with his pen, Langdon's fingers were trembling. There before him on the map was a giant cruciform. It's a cross. The four elements of science unfolded before his eyes, sprawled across Rome in an enormous city-wide cross. As he stared in wonder, a line of poetry rang in his mind, like an old friend with a new face. Cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. Cross Rome. The fog began to clear. Langdon saw that the answer had been in front of him all night. The Illuminati poem had been telling him how the altars were laid out. A cross. Cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. It was cunning wordplay. Langdon had originally read the word cross as an abbreviation of a cross. He assumed it was poetic license, intended to retain the meter of the poem. But it was so much more than that. Another hidden clue. The cruciform on the map, Langdon realized, was the ultimate Illuminati duality. It was a religious symbol formed by elements of science. Galileo's path of illumination was a tribute to both God and science. The rest of the puzzle fell into place almost immediately. Piazza Navona. Dead center of Piazza Navona, outside the Church of St. Agnes in Agony, Bernini had forged one of his most celebrated sculptures. Everyone who came to Rome went to see it. The Fountain of the Four Rivers. A flawless tribute to water, Bernini's Fountain of the Four Rivers glorified the four major rivers of the Old World: the Nile, the Ganges, Danube, and Rio Plata. Water, Langdon thought, the final marker. It was perfect. And even more perfect, Langdon realized, the cherry on the cake, was that high atop Bernini's fountain stood a towering obelisk. Leaving confused firemen in his wake, Langdon ran across the church in the direction of Olivetti's lifeless body. 10:31 p.m., he thought. Plenty of time. It was the first instant all day that Langdon felt ahead of the game. Kneeling beside Olivetti, out of sight behind some pews, Langdon discreetly took possession of the commander's semi-automatic and walkie-talkie. Langdon knew he would call for help, but this was not the place to do it. The final altar of science needed to remain a secret for now. The media and fire department racing with sirens blaring to Piazza Navona would be no help at all. Without a word, Langdon slipped out the door and skirted the press, who were now entering the church in droves. He crossed Piazza Barberini. In the shadows, he turned on the walkie-talkie. He tried to hail Vatican City, but heard nothing but static. He was either out of range, or the transmitter needed some kind of authorization code. Langdon adjusted the complex dials and buttons to no avail. Abruptly, he realized his plan to get help was not going to work. He spun, looking for a payphone. None. The Vatican circuits were jammed anyway. He was alone. Feeling his initial surge of confidence decay, Langdon stood a moment and took stock of his pitiful state. Covered in bone dust, cut, deliriously exhausted and hungry. Langdon glanced back at the church. Smoke spiraled over the cupola, lit by the media lights and fire trucks. He wondered if he should go back and get help. Instinct warned him, however, that extra help, especially untrained help, would be nothing but a liability. If the Hashashin sees us coming, he thought of Vittoria, and knew this would be his final chance to face her captor. Piazza Navona, he thought, knowing he could get there in plenty of time and stake it out. He scanned the area for a taxi, but the streets were almost entirely deserted. Even the taxi drivers, it seemed, had dropped everything to find a television. Piazza Navona was only about a mile away, but Langdon had no intention of wasting precious energy on foot. He glanced back at the church, wondering if he could borrow a vehicle from someone. A fire truck, a press van. Be serious. Sensing options and minutes slipping away, Langdon made his decision. Pulling the gun from his pocket, he committed an act so out of character that he suspected his soul must now be possessed. Running over to a lone Citroen sedan idling at a stoplight, Langdon pointed the weapon through the driver's open window. 40! He yelled. The trembling man got out. Langdon jumped behind the wheel and hit the gas. Chapter 101 Gunther Glick sat on a bench in a holding tank inside the office of the Swiss Guard. He prayed to every god he could think of, "Please, let this not be a dream." It had been the scoop of his life, the scoop of anyone's life. Every reporter on Earth wished he were Glick right now. "You are awake," he told himself, "and you are a star. Dan Rather is crying right now." Macri was beside him, looking a little bit stunned. Glick didn't blame her. In addition to exclusively broadcasting the Camerlengo's address, she and Glick had provided the world with gruesome photos of the cardinals and of the Pope. That tongue! As well as a live video feed of the antimatter canister counting down. Incredible! Of course, all of that had all been at the Camerlengo's behest, so that was not the reason Glick and Macri were now locked in a Swiss Guard holding tank. It had been Glick's daring addendum to their coverage that the guards had not appreciated. Glick knew the conversation on which he had just reported was not intended for his ears, but this was his moment in the sun, another Glick scoop. "The 11th hour, Samaritan," Macri groaned on the bench beside him, clearly unimpressed. Glick smiled. "Brilliant, wasn't it?" "Brilliantly dumb." "She's just jealous," Glick knew. Shortly after the Camerlengo's address, Glick had again by chance been in the right place at the right time. He'd overheard Rocher giving new orders to his men. Apparently, Rocher had received a phone call from a mysterious individual who Rocher claimed had critical information regarding the current crisis. Rocher was talking as if this man could help them and was advising his guards to prepare for the guest's arrival. Although the information was clearly private, Glick had acted as any dedicated reporter would, without honor. He found a dark corner, ordered Macri to fire up a remote camera, and he'd reported the news. "Shocking new developments in God's City," he had announced, squinting his eyes for added intensity. Then he'd gone on to say that a mystery guest was coming to Vatican City to save the day. The 11th-hour Samaritan, Glick had called him. A perfect name for the faceless man appearing at the last moment to do a good deed. The other networks had picked up the catchy soundbite, and Glick was yet again immortalized.
"I'm brilliant," he mused. "Peter Jennings just jumped off a bridge."
Of course, Glick hadn't stopped there. While he had the world's attention, he had thrown in a little of his own conspiracy theory for good measure.
"Brilliant. Utterly brilliant."
"You screwed us," Macri said. "You totally blew it."
"What do you mean? I was great."
Macri stared disbelievingly. "Former President George Bush? An Illuminatus?" Glick smiled. How much more obvious could it be? George Bush was a well-documented 33-degree Mason, and he was the head of the CIA when the agency closed their Illuminati investigation for lack of evidence. And all those speeches about 1,000 points of light and a new world order? Bush was obviously Illuminati. "And that bit about CERN," Macri chided. "You're going to have a very big line of lawyers outside your door tomorrow."
"CERN? Oh, come on, it's so obvious. Think about it. The Illuminati disappear off the face of the Earth in the 1950s, at about the same time CERN is founded. CERN is a haven for the most enlightened people on Earth. Tons of private funding. They build a weapon that can destroy the Church, and, oops, they lose it."
"So you tell the world that CERN is the new home base of the Illuminati?"
"Obviously. Brotherhoods don't just disappear. The Illuminati had to go somewhere. CERN is a perfect place for them to hide. I'm not saying everyone at CERN is Illuminati. It's probably like a huge Masonic lodge, where most people are innocent, but the upper echelons..."
"Have you ever heard of slander, Glick? Liability? Have you ever heard of real journalism?"
"Journalism? You were pulling bullshit out of thin air. I should have turned off the camera. And what the hell was that crap about CERN's corporate logo? Satanic symbology? Have you lost your mind?"
Glick smiled. Macri's jealousy was definitely showing. The CERN logo had been the most brilliant coup of all. Ever since the Camerlengo's address, all the networks were talking about CERN and antimatter. Some stations were showing the CERN corporate logo as a backdrop. The logo seemed standard enough, two intersecting circles representing two particle accelerators, and five tangential lines representing particle injection tubes. The whole world was staring at this logo, but it had been Glick, a bit of a symbologist himself, who had first seen the Illuminati symbology hidden in it.
"You're not a symbologist," Macri chided. "You're just one lucky-ass reporter. You should have left the symbology to the Harvard guy."
"The Harvard guy missed it," Glick said. "The Illuminati's significance in this logo is so obvious." He was beaming inside. Although CERN had lots of accelerators, their logo showed only two. Two is the Illuminati number of duality. Although most accelerators had only one injection tube, the logo showed five. Five is the number of the Illuminati pentagram. Then had come the coup, the most brilliant point of all. Glick pointed out that the logo contained a large numeral six, clearly formed by one of the lines and circles. And when the logo was rotated, another six appeared, and then another. The logo contained three sixes. 666, the devil's number, the mark of the beast. Glick was a genius. Macri looked ready to slug him. The jealousy would pass, Glick knew, his mind now wandering to another thought. If CERN was Illuminati headquarters, was CERN where the Illuminati kept their infamous Illuminati diamond? Glick had read about it on the Internet. A flawless diamond, born of the ancient elements with such perfection that all those who saw it could only stand in wonder. Glick wondered if the secret whereabouts of the Illuminati diamond might be yet another mystery he could unveil tonight. Chapter 102. Piazza Navona, Fountain of the Four Rivers. Nights in Rome, like those in the desert, can be surprisingly cool, even after a warm day. Langdon was huddled now on the fringes of Piazza Navona, pulling his jacket around him. Like the distant white noise of traffic, a cacophony of news reports echoed across the city. He checked his watch. 15 minutes. He was grateful for a few moments of rest. The piazza was deserted. Bernini's masterful fountain sizzled before him with a fearful sorcery. The foaming pool sent a magical mist upward, lit from beneath by underwater floodlights. Langdon sensed a cool electricity in the air. The fountain's most arresting quality was its height. The central core alone was over 20 feet tall, a rugged mountain of travertine marble riddled with caves and grottos through which the water churned. The entire mound was draped with pagan figures. Atop this stood an obelisk that climbed another 40 feet. Langdon let his eyes climb. On the obelisk's tip, a faint shadow blotted the sky. A lone pigeon perched silently. A cross, Langdon thought, still amazed by the arrangement of the markers across Rome. Bernini's Fountain of the Four Rivers was the last altar of science. Only hours ago, Langdon had been standing in the Pantheon, convinced the path of illumination had been broken, and he would never get this far. It had been a foolish blunder. In fact, the entire path was intact. Earth, air, fire, water. And Langdon had followed it, from beginning to end. Not quite to the end, he reminded himself. The path had 5 stops, not 4. This 4th marker fountain somehow pointed to the ultimate destiny. The Illuminati's sacred lair, the Church of Illumination. Langdon wondered if the lair was still standing. He wondered if that was where the Hashashin had taken Vittoria. Langdon found his eyes probing the figures in the fountain, looking for any clue as to the direction of the lair. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Almost immediately, though, he was overcome by an unsettling awareness. The fountain contained no angels whatsoever. It certainly contained none Langdon could see from where he was standing, and none he had ever seen in the past. The Fountain of the Four Rivers was a pagan work. The carvings were all profane. Humans, animals, even an awkward armadillo. An angel here would stick out like a sore thumb. Is this the wrong place? He considered the cruciform arrangement of the 4 obelisks. He clenched his fists. This fountain is perfect. It was only 10:46 p.m. when a black van emerged from the alleyway on the far side of the piazza. Langdon wouldn't have given it a second look, except that the van drove with no headlights. Like a shark patrolling a moonlit bay, the vehicle circled the perimeter of the piazza. Langdon hunkered lower, crouched in the shadows beside the huge stairway leading up to the Church of St. Agnes in Agony. He gazed out at the piazza, his pulse climbing. After making 2 complete circuits, the van banked inward toward Bernini's fountain. It pulled abreast of the basin, moving laterally along the rim until its side was flush with the fountain. Then it parked, its sliding door positioned only inches above the churning water. Mist billowed. Langdon felt an uneasy premonition. Had the Hashashin arrived early? Had he come in a van? Langdon had imagined the killer escorting his last victim across the piazza on foot, like he had at St. Peter's, giving Langdon an open shot. But if the Hashashin had arrived in a van, the rules had just changed. Suddenly the van's side door slid open. On the floor of the van, contorted in agony, lay a naked man. The man was wrapped in yards of heavy chains. He thrashed against the iron links, but the chains were too heavy. One of the links bisected the man's mouth like a horse's bit, stifling his cries for help. It was then that Langdon saw the second figure, moving around behind the prisoner in the dark, as though making final preparations. Langdon knew he had only seconds to act. Taking the gun, he slipped off his jacket and dropped it on the ground. He didn't want the added encumbrance of a tweed jacket, nor did he have any intention of taking Galileo's diagramma anywhere near the water. The document would stay here, where it was safe and dry. Langdon scrambled to his right. Circling the perimeter of the fountain, he positioned himself directly opposite the van. The fountain's massive centerpiece obscured his view. Standing, he ran directly toward the basin. He hoped the thundering water was drowning his footsteps. When he reached the fountain, he climbed over the rim and dropped into the foaming pool. The water was waist-deep and like ice. Langdon gritted his teeth and plowed through the water. The bottom was slippery, made doubly treacherous by a stratum of coins thrown for good luck. Langdon sensed he would need more than good luck. As the mist rose all around him, he wondered if it was the cold or the fear that was causing the gun in his hand to shake. He reached the interior of the fountain and circled back to his left. He waded hard, clinging to the cover of the marble forms. Hiding himself behind a huge carved form of a horse, Langdon peered out. The van was only 15 feet away. The Hashashin was crouched on the floor of the van, hands planted on the cardinal's chain-clad body, preparing to roll him out the open door into the fountain. Waist-deep in water, Robert Langdon raised his gun and stepped out of the mist, feeling like some sort of aquatic cowboy making a final stand.
"Don't move!"
His voice was steadier than the gun. The Hashashin looked up. For a moment he seemed confused, as though he had seen a ghost. Then his lips curved into an evil smile. He raised his arms in submission.
"And so it goes. Get out of the van. You look wet. You're early. I am eager to return to my prize."
Langdon leveled the gun.
"I won't hesitate to shoot." "You've already hesitated."
Langdon felt his finger tighten on the trigger. The cardinal lay motionless now. He looked exhausted, moribund.
"Untie him." "Forget it. You've come for the woman. Do not pretend otherwise."
Langdon fought the urge to end it right there.
"Where is she?" "Somewhere safe, awaiting my return."
"She's alive." Langdon felt a ray of hope. "At the Church of Illumination?" The killer smiled.
"You will never find its location."
Langdon was incredulous. The lair is still standing. He aimed the gun.
"Where?" "The location has remained secret for centuries. Even to me, it was only revealed recently. I would die before I break that trust."
"I can find it without you."
"An arrogant thought."
Langdon motioned to the fountain.
"I've come this far." "So have many. The final step is the hardest."
Langdon stepped closer, his footing tentative beneath the water. The Hashashin looked remarkably calm, squatting there in the back of the van with his arms raised over his head. Langdon aimed at his chest, wondering if he should simply shoot and be done with it.
"No, he knows where Vittoria is. He knows where the antimatter is. I need information."
From the darkness of the van, the Hashashin gazed out at his aggressor and couldn't help but feel an amused pity. The American was brave, that he had proven, but he was also untrained. That he had also proven. Valor without expertise was suicide. There were rules of survival, ancient rules, and the American was breaking all of them.
"You had the advantage, the element of surprise. You squandered it."
The American was indecisive, hoping for backup, most likely, or perhaps a slip of the tongue that would reveal critical information.
"Never interrogate before you disable your prey. A cornered enemy is a deadly enemy." The American was talking again, probing, maneuvering. The killer almost laughed out loud. "This is not one of your Hollywood movies.
There will be no long discussions at gunpoint before the final shootout. This is the end. Now.
Without breaking eye contact, the killer inched his hands across the ceiling of the van until he found what he was looking for. Staring dead ahead, he grasped it. Then he made his play. The motion was utterly unexpected. For an instant, Langdon thought the laws of physics had ceased to exist. The killer seemed to hang weightless in the air as his legs shot out from beneath him, his boots driving into the cardinal's side and launching the chain-laden body out the door. The cardinal splashed down, sending up a sheet of spray. Water dousing his face, Langdon realized too late what had happened. The killer had grasped one of the van's roll bars and used it to swing outward. Now the Hashashin was sailing toward him, feet first, through the spray. Langdon pulled the trigger, and the silencer spat. The bullet exploded through the toe of the Hashashin's left boot. Instantly, Langdon felt the soles of the Hashashin's boots connect with his chest, driving him back with a crushing kick. The two men splashed down in a spray of blood and water. As the icy liquid engulfed Langdon's body, his first cognition was pain. Survival instinct came next. He realized he was no longer holding his weapon. It had been knocked away. Diving deep, he groped along the slimy bottom. His hand gripped metal. A handful of coins. He dropped them. Opening his eyes, Langdon scanned the glowing basin. The water churned around him like a frigid jacuzzi. Despite the instinct to breathe, fear kept him on the bottom. Always moving. He didn't know from where the next assault would come. He needed to find the gun. His hands groped desperately in front of him. "You have the advantage," he told himself. "You're in your element." Even in a soaked turtleneck, Langdon was an agile swimmer. Water is your element. When Langdon's fingers found metal a second time, he was certain his luck had changed. The object in his hand was no handful of coins. He gripped it and tried to pull it toward him, but when he did, he found himself gliding through the water. The object was stationary. Langdon realized even before he coasted over the cardinal's writhing body that he had grasped part of the metal chain that was weighing the man down. Langdon hovered a moment, immobilized by the sight of the terrified face staring up at him from the floor of the fountain. Jolted by the life in the man's eyes, Langdon reached down and grabbed the chains, trying to heave him toward the surface. The body came slowly, like an anchor. Langdon pulled harder. When the cardinal's head broke the surface, the old man gasped a few sucking, desperate breaths. Then, violently, his body rolled, causing Langdon to lose his grip on the slippery chains. Like a stone, Baja went down again and disappeared beneath the foaming water. Langdon dove, eyes wide in the liquid murkiness. He found the cardinal. This time, when Langdon grabbed on, the chains across Baja's chest shifted, parting to reveal a further wickedness. A word stamped in seared flesh. Water. An instant later, two boots strode into view. One was gushing blood. Chapter 103. As a water polo player, Langdon had endured more than his fair share of underwater battles. The competitive savagery that raged beneath the surface of a water polo pool, away from the eyes of the referees, could rival even the ugliest wrestling match. Langdon had been kicked, scratched, held, and even bitten once by a frustrated defenseman from whom Langdon had continuously twisted away. Now, though, thrashing in the frigid water of Bernini's fountain, Langdon knew he was a long way from the Harvard pool. He was fighting not for a game, but for his life. This was the second time they had battled. No referees here, no rematches. The arms driving his face toward the bottom of the basin thrust with a force that left no doubt that it intended to kill. Langdon instinctively spun like a torpedo. "Break the hold!" But the grip torqued him back, his attacker enjoying an advantage no water polo defenseman ever had, 2 feet on solid ground. Langdon contorted, trying to get his own feet beneath him. The Hashashin seemed to be favoring one arm, but nonetheless his grip held firm. It was then that Langdon knew he was not coming up. He did the only thing he could think of to do. He stopped trying to surface. If you can't go north, go east. Marshaling the last of his strength, Langdon dolphin-kicked his legs and pulled his arms beneath him in an awkward butterfly stroke. His body lurched forward. The sudden switch in direction seemed to take the Hashashin off guard. Langdon's lateral motion dragged his captor's arms sideways, compromising his balance. The man's grip faltered, and Langdon kicked again. The sensation felt like a tow line had snapped. Suddenly, Langdon was free. Blowing the stale air from his lungs, Langdon clawed for the surface. A single breath was all he got. With crashing force, the Hashashin was on top of him again, palms on his shoulders, all of his weight bearing down. Langdon scrambled to plant his feet beneath him, but the Hashashin's legs swung out, cutting Langdon down. He went under again. Langdon's muscles burned as he twisted beneath the water. This time his maneuvers were in vain. Through the bubbling water, Langdon scanned the bottom, looking for the gun. Everything was blurred. The bubbles were denser here. A blinding light flashed in his face as the killer wrestled him deeper toward a submerged spotlight bolted on the floor of the fountain. Langdon reached out, grabbing the canister. It was hot. Langdon tried to pull himself free, but the contraption was mounted on hinges and pivoted in his hand. His leverage was instantly lost. The Hashashin drove him deeper still. It was then Langdon saw it. Poking out from under the coins, directly beneath his face, a narrow black cylinder. The silencer of Olivetti's gun. Langdon reached out, but as his fingers wrapped around the cylinder, he did not feel metal. He felt plastic. When he pulled, the flexible rubber hose came flopping toward him like a flimsy snake. It was about 2 feet long, with a jet of bubbles surging from the end. Langdon had not found the gun at all. It was one of the fountain's many harmless spumanti. Bubble makers. Only a few feet away, Cardinal Baja felt his soul straining to leave his body. Although he had prepared for this moment his entire life, he had never imagined the end would be like this. His physical shell was in agony, burned, bruised, and held underwater by an immovable weight. He reminded himself that this suffering was nothing compared to what Jesus had endured. He died for my sins. Baja could hear the thrashing of a battle raging nearby. He couldn't bear the thought of it. His captor was about to extinguish yet another life. The man with kind eyes, the man who had tried to help. As the pain mounted, Baja lay on his back and stared up through the water at the black sky above him. For a moment he thought he saw stars. It was time. Releasing all fear and doubt, Baja opened his mouth and expelled what he knew would be his final breath. He watched his spirit gurgle heavenward in a burst of transparent bubbles. Then, reflexively, he gasped. The water poured in like icy daggers to his sides. The pain lasted only a few seconds. Then, peace. The Hashashin ignored the burning in his foot and focused on the drowning American, whom he now held pinned beneath him in the churning water. Finish it fully. He tightened his grip, knowing this time Robert Langdon would not survive. As he predicted, his victim's struggling became weaker and weaker. Suddenly, Langdon's body went rigid. He began to shake wildly. Yes, the Hashashin mused, the rigors. When the water first hits the lungs. The rigors, he knew, would last about 5 seconds. They lasted 6. Then, exactly as the Hashashin expected, his victim went suddenly flaccid. Like a great deflating balloon, Robert Langdon fell limp. It was over. The Hashashin held him down for another 30 seconds to let the water flood all of his pulmonary tissue. Gradually, he felt Langdon's body sink on its own accord to the bottom. Finally, the Hashashin let go. The media would find a double surprise in the Fountain of the Four Rivers. "Taban!" the Hashashin swore. clambering out of the fountain and looking at his bleeding toe. The tip of his boot was shredded, and the front of his big toe had been sheared off. Angry at his own carelessness, he tore the cuff from his pant leg and rammed the fabric into the toe of his boot. Pain shot up his leg.
Ibn al-Kab!
He clenched his fists and rammed the cloth deeper. The bleeding slowed until it was only a trickle. Turning his thoughts from pain to pleasure, the Hashashin got into his van. His work in Rome was done. He knew exactly what he would do to soothe his discomfort. Vittoria Vetra was bound and waiting. The Hashashin, even cold and wet, felt himself stiffen.
I have earned my reward.
Across town, Vittoria awoke in pain. She was on her back. All of her muscles felt like stone. Tight, brittle. Her arms hurt. When she tried to move, she felt spasms in her shoulders. It took her a moment to comprehend her hands were tied behind her back. Her initial reaction was confusion. Am I dreaming? But when she tried to lift her head, the pain at the base of her skull informed her of her wakefulness. Confusion transforming to fear, she scanned her surroundings. She was in a crude stone room, large and well-furnished, lit by torches. Some kind of ancient meeting hall. Old-fashioned benches sat in a circle nearby. Vittoria felt a breeze, cold now on her skin. Nearby, a set of double doors stood open, beyond them a balcony. Through the slits in the balustrade, Vittoria could have sworn she saw the Vatican. Chapter 104 Robert Langdon lay on a bed of coins at the bottom of the Fountain of the Four Rivers. His mouth was still wrapped around the plastic hose. The air being pumped through the spumante tube to froth the fountain had been polluted by the pump, and his throat burned. He was not complaining, though. He was alive. He was not sure how accurate his imitation of a drowning man had been, but having been around water his entire life, Langdon had certainly heard accounts. He had done his best. Near the end, he had even blown all the air from his lungs and stopped breathing so that his muscle mass would carry his body to the floor. Thankfully, the Hashashin had bought it and let go. Now, resting on the bottom of the fountain, Langdon had waited as long as he could wait. He was about to start choking. He wondered if the Hashashin was still out there. Taking an acrid breath from the tube, Langdon let go and swam across the bottom of the fountain until he found the smooth swell of the central core. Silently, he followed it upward, surfacing out of sight in the shadows beneath the huge marble figures. The van was gone. That was all Langdon needed to see. Pulling a long breath of fresh air back into his lungs, he scrambled back toward where Cardinal Baja had gone down. Langdon knew the man would be unconscious now, and chances of revival were slim, but he had to try. When Langdon found the body, he planted his feet on either side, reached down, and grabbed the chains wrapped around the cardinal. Then Langdon pulled. When the cardinal broke water, Langdon could see the eyes were already rolled upward, bulging. Not a good sign. There was no breath or pulse. Knowing he could never get the body up and over the fountain rim, Langdon lugged Cardinal Baja through the water and into the hollow beneath the central mound of marble. Here the water became shallow, and there was an inclined ledge. Langdon dragged the naked body up onto the ledge as far as he could. Not far. Then he went to work. Compressing the Cardinal's chain-clad chest, Langdon pumped the water from his lungs. Then he began CPR, counting carefully, deliberately, resisting the instinct to blow too hard and too fast. For 3 minutes, Langdon tried to revive the old man. After 5 minutes, Langdon knew it was over. El Preferito, the man who would be Pope, lying dead before him. Somehow, even now, prostrate in the shadows on the semi-submerged ledge, Cardinal Baja retained an air of quiet dignity. The water lapped softly across his chest, seeming almost remorseful, as if asking forgiveness for being the man's ultimate killer, as if trying to cleanse the scalded wound that bore its name. Gently, Langdon ran a hand across the man's face and closed his upturned eyes. As he did, he felt an exhausted shudder of tears well from within. It startled him. Then, for the first time in years, Langdon cried. Chapter 105. The fog of weary emotion lifted slowly as Langdon waded away from the dead cardinal back into deep water. Depleted and alone in the fountain, Langdon half expected to collapse. But instead he felt a new compulsion rising within him, undeniable, frantic. He sensed his muscles hardening with an unexpected grit. His mind, as though ignoring the pain in his heart, forced aside the past and brought into focus the single desperate task ahead. Find the Illuminati lair. Help Vittoria. Turning now to the mountainous core of Bernini's fountain, Langdon summoned hope and launched himself into his quest for the final Illuminati marker. He knew somewhere in this gnarled mass of figures was a clue that pointed to the lair. As Langdon scanned the fountain, though, his hope withered quickly. The words of the Señor seemed to gurgle mockingly all around him. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Langdon glared at the carved forms before him. The fountain is pagan. It has no damn angels anywhere. When Langdon completed his fruitless search of the core, his eyes instinctively climbed the towering stone pillar. Four markers, he thought, spread across Rome in a giant cross. Scanning the hieroglyphics covering the obelisk, he wondered if perhaps there was a clue hidden in the Egyptian symbology. He immediately dismissed the idea. The hieroglyphs predated Bernini by centuries, and hieroglyphs had not even been decipherable until the Rosetta Stone was discovered. Still, Langdon ventured, maybe Bernini had carved an additional symbol, one that would go unnoticed among all the hieroglyphs. Feeling a shimmer of hope, Langdon circumnavigated the fountain one more time and studied all four facades of the obelisk. It took him 2 minutes, and when he reached the end of the final face, his hope sank. Nothing in the hieroglyphs stood out as any kind of addition. Certainly no angels. Langdon checked his watch. It was 11 on the dot. He couldn't tell whether time was flying or crawling. Images of Vittoria and the Hashashin started to swirl hauntingly as Langdon clambered his way around the fountain, the frustration mounting as he frantically completed yet another fruitless circle. Beaten and exhausted, Langdon felt ready to collapse. He threw back his head to scream into the night. The sound jammed in his throat. Langdon was staring straight up the obelisk. The object perched at the very top was one he had seen earlier and ignored. Now, however, it stopped him short. It wasn't an angel. Far from it. In fact, he hadn't even perceived it as part of Bernini's fountain. He thought it was a living creature, another one of the city's scavengers perched on a lofty tower. A pigeon. Langdon squinted skyward at the object, his vision blurred by the glowing mist around him. It was a pigeon, wasn't it? He could clearly see the head and beak silhouetted against a cluster of stars. And yet the bird hadn't budged since Langdon's arrival, even with the battle below. The bird sat now exactly as it had been when Langdon entered the square. It was perched high atop the obelisk, gazing calmly westward. Langdon stared at it a moment, and then plunged his hand into the fountain and grabbed a fistful of coins. He hurled the coins skyward. They clattered across the upper levels of the granite obelisk. The bird didn't budge. He tried again. This time one of the coins hit the mark. A faint sound of metal on metal clanged across the square. The damned pigeon was bronze. "You're looking for an angel, not a pigeon," a voice reminded him. But it was too late. Langdon had made the connection. He realized the bird was not a pigeon at all. It was a dove. Barely aware of his own actions, Langdon splashed toward the center of the fountain and began scrambling up the travertine mountain, clambering over huge arms and heads, pulling himself higher. Halfway to the base of the obelisk, he emerged from the mist and could see the head of the bird more clearly. There was no doubt. It was a dove. The bird's deceptively dark color was the result of Rome's pollution tarnishing the original bronze. Then the significance hit him. He had seen a pair of doves earlier today at the Pantheon. A pair of doves carried no meaning. This dove, however, was alone. The lone dove is the pagan symbol for the angel of peace. The truth almost lifted Langdon the rest of the way to the obelisk. Bernini had chosen the pagan symbol for the angel so he could disguise it in a pagan fountain. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. The dove is the angel. Langdon could think of no more lofty perch for the Illuminati's final marker than atop this obelisk. The bird was looking west. Langdon tried to follow its gaze, but he couldn't see over the buildings. He climbed higher. A quote from St. Gregory of Nyssa emerged from his memory almost unexpectedly. As the soul becomes enlightened, it takes the beautiful shape of a dove. Langdon rose heavenward, toward the dove. He was almost flying now. He reached the platform from which the obelisk rose and could climb no higher. With one look around, though, he knew he didn't have to. All of Rome spread out before him. The view was stunning. To his left, the chaotic media lights surrounding St. Peter's. To his right, the smoking cupola of Santa Maria della Vittoria. In front of him, in the distance, Piazza del Popolo. Beneath him, the fourth and final point, a giant cross of obelisks. Trembling, Langdon looked at the dove overhead. He turned and faced the proper direction, and then he lowered his eyes to the skyline. In an instant, he saw it. So obvious, so clear, so deviously simple. Staring at it now, Langdon could not believe the Illuminati lair had stayed hidden for so many years. The entire city seemed to fade away as he looked out at the monstrous stone structure across the river in front of him. The building was as famous as any in Rome. It stood on the banks of the Tiber River, diagonally adjacent to the Vatican. The building's geometry was stark, a circular castle within a square fortress, and then, outside its walls, surrounding the entire structure, a park in the shape of a pentagram. The ancient stone ramparts before him were dramatically lit by soft floodlights. High atop the castle stood the mammoth bronze angel. The angel pointed his sword downward at the exact center of the castle. And as if that were not enough, leading solely and directly to the castle's main entrance, stood the famous Bridge of Angels, a dramatic approachway adorned by 12 towering angels carved by none other than Bernini himself. In a final, breathtaking revelation, Langdon realized Bernini's citywide cross of obelisks marked the fortress in perfect Illuminati fashion. The cross's central arm passed directly through the center of the castle's bridge, dividing it into two equal halves. Langdon retrieved his tweed coat, holding it away from his dripping body. Then he jumped into the stolen sedan and rammed his soggy shoe into the accelerator, speeding off into the night. Chapter 106. It was 11:07 p.m. Langdon's car raced through the Roman night. Speeding down Lungo Tevere toward Inona, parallel with the river, Langdon could now see his destination rising like a mountain to his right. Castel Sant'Angelo, Castle of the Angel. Without warning, the turnoff to the narrow Bridge of Angels, Ponte Sant'Angelo, appeared suddenly. Langdon slammed on his brakes and swerved. He turned in time, but the bridge was barricaded. He skidded 10 feet and collided with a series of short cement pillars blocking his way. Langdon lurched forward as the vehicle stalled, wheezing and shuddering. He had forgotten the Bridge of Angels, in order to preserve it, was now zoned pedestrians only. Shaken, Langdon staggered from the crumpled car, wishing now he had chosen one of the other routes. He felt chilled, shivering from the fountain. He donned his Harris tweed over his damp shirt, grateful for Harris's trademark double lining. The diagramma folio would remain dry. Before him, across the bridge, the stone fortress rose like a mountain. Aching and depleted, Langdon broke into a loping run. On both sides of him now, like a gauntlet of escorts, a procession of Bernini angels whipped past, funneling him toward his final destination. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. The castle seemed to rise as he advanced, an unscalable peak, more intimidating to him even than St. Peter's. He sprinted toward the bastion, running on fumes, gazing upward at the citadel's circular core as it shot skyward to a gargantuan sword-wielding angel. The castle appeared deserted. Langdon knew through the centuries the building had been used by the Vatican as a tomb, a fortress, a papal hideout, a prison for enemies of the church, and a museum. Apparently the castle had other tenants as well. The Illuminati. Somehow it made eerie sense. Although the castle was property of the Vatican, it was used only sporadically, and Bernini had made numerous renovations to it over the years. The building was now rumored to be honeycombed with secret entries, passageways, and hidden chambers. Langdon had little doubt that the Angel and surrounding pentagonal park were Bernini's doing as well. Arriving at the castle's elephantine double doors, Langdon shoved them hard. Not surprisingly, they were immovable. Two iron knockers hung at eye level. Langdon didn't bother. He stepped back, his eyes climbing the sheer outer wall. These ramparts had fended off armies of Berbers, heathens, and Moors. Somehow he sensed his chances of breaking in were slim. "Vittoria," Langdon thought. "Are you in there?" Langdon hurried around the outer wall. There must be another entrance. Rounding the second bulwark to the west, Langdon arrived breathless in a small parking area off Lungotere Angelo. On this wall he found a second castle entrance, a drawbridge-type ingress raised and sealed shut. Langdon gazed upward again. The only lights on the castle were exterior floods illuminating the facade. All the tiny windows inside seemed black. Langdon's eyes climbed higher. At the very peak of the central tower, 100 feet above, directly beneath the angel's sword, a single balcony protruded. The marble parapet seemed to shimmer slightly, as if the room beyond it were aglow with torchlight. Langdon paused, his soaked body shivering suddenly. A shadow? He waited, straining. Then he saw it again. His spine prickled. "Someone is up there." "Vittoria!" he called out, unable to help himself, but his voice was swallowed by the raging Tiber behind him. He wheeled in circles, wondering where the hell the Swiss Guard were. Had they even heard his transmission? Across the lot, a large media truck was parked. Langdon ran toward it. A paunchy man in headphones sat in the cabin adjusting levers. Langdon rapped on the side of the truck. The man jumped, saw Langdon's dripping clothes, and yanked off his headset. "What's the worry, mate?" His accent was Australian. "I need your phone." Langdon was frenzied. The man shrugged.
"No dial tone. Been trying all night. Circuits are packed."
Langdon swore aloud. "Have you seen anyone go in there?" He pointed to the drawbridge.
"Actually, yeah. A black van's been going in and out all night."
Langdon felt a brick hit the bottom of his stomach.
"Lucky bastard,"
the Aussie said, gazing up at the tower and then frowning at his obstructed view of the Vatican.
"How about the view from up there? It's perfect. I couldn't get through the traffic in St. Peter's, so I'm shooting from here."
Langdon wasn't listening. He was looking for options.
"What do you say?" the Australian said. "This 11th hour Samaritan for real?"
Langdon turned.
The what?
You didn't hear? The captain of the Swiss Guard got a call from somebody who claims to have some primo info. The guy's flying in right now. All I know is if he saves the day, there go the ratings.
The man laughed. Langdon was suddenly confused. A good Samaritan flying in to help? Did the person somehow know where the antimatter was? Then why didn't he just tell the Swiss Guard? Why was he coming in person? Something was odd, but Langdon didn't have time to figure out what.
Hey,
the Aussie said, studying Langdon more closely.
Ain't you that guy I saw on TV? Trying to save that cardinal in St. Peter's Square?
Langdon didn't answer. His eyes had suddenly locked on a contraption attached to the top of the truck, a satellite dish on a collapsible appendage. Langdon looked at the castle again. The outer rampart was 50 feet tall. The inner fortress climbed farther still, a shelled defense. The top was impossibly high from here, but maybe if he could clear the first wall. Langdon spun to the newsman and pointed to the satellite arm.
How high does that go?
Huh? The man looked confused.
15 meters. Why?
Move the truck. Park next to the wall. I need help.
What are you talking about?
Langdon explained. The Aussie's eyes went wide.
Are you insane? This is a $200,000 telescope and extension, not a ladder.
You want ratings? I've got information that will make your day. Langdon was desperate.
Information worth 200 grand?
Langdon told him what he would reveal in exchange for the favor. 90 seconds later, Robert Langdon was gripping the top of the satellite arm, wavering in the breeze 50 feet off the ground. Leaning out, he grabbed the top of the first bulwark, dragged himself onto the wall, and dropped onto the castle's lower bastion.
"Now keep your bargain," the Aussie called up. "Where is he?"
Langdon felt guilt-ridden for revealing this information, but a deal was a deal. Besides, the Hashashin would probably call the press anyway.
"Piazza Navona," Langdon shouted. "He's in the fountain."
The Aussie lowered his satellite dish and peeled out after the scoop of his career. In a stone chamber high above the city, the Hashashin removed his soaking boots and bandaged his wounded toe. There was pain, but not so much that he couldn't enjoy himself. He turned to his prize. She was in the corner of the room, on her back, on a rudimentary divan, hands tied behind her, mouth gagged. The Hashashin moved toward her. She was awake now. This pleased him. Surprisingly, in her eyes, he saw fire instead of fear. The fear will come. Chapter 107 Robert Langdon dashed around the outer bulwark of the castle, grateful for the glow of the floodlights. As he circled the wall, the courtyard beneath him looked like a museum of ancient warfare. Catapults, stacks of marble cannonballs, and an arsenal of fearful contraptions. Parts of the castle were open to tourists during the day, and the courtyard had been partially restored to its original state. Langdon's eyes crossed the courtyard to the central core of the fortress. The circular citadel shot skyward 107 feet to the bronze angel above. The balcony at the top still glowed from within. Langdon wanted to call out, but knew better. He would have to find a way in. He checked his watch. 11:12 p.m. Dashing down the stone ramp that hugged the inside of the wall, Langdon descended to the courtyard. Back on ground level, he ran through shadows, clockwise around the fort. He passed 3 porticos, but all of them were permanently sealed.
How did the Hashashin get in?
Langdon pushed on. He passed 2 modern entrances, but they were padlocked from the outside.
Not here.
He kept running. Langdon had circled almost the entire building when he saw a gravel drive cutting across the courtyard in front of him. At one end, on the outer wall of the castle, he saw the back of the gated drawbridge leading back outside. At the other end, the drive disappeared into the fortress. The drive seemed to enter a kind of tunnel, a gaping entry in the central core. Il Traforo. Langdon had read about this castle's traforo, a giant spiral ramp that circled up inside the fort, used by commanders on horseback to ride from top to bottom rapidly. The Hashashin drove up. The gate blocking the tunnel was raised, ushering Langdon in. He felt almost exuberant as he ran toward the tunnel. But as he reached the opening, his excitement disappeared. The tunnel spiraled down. The wrong way. This section of the Traforo apparently descended to the dungeons, not to the top. Standing at the mouth of a dark bore that seemed to twist endlessly deeper into the earth, Langdon hesitated, looking up again at the balcony. He could swear he saw motion up there. Decide! With no other options, he dashed down into the tunnel. High overhead, the Hashashin stood over his prey. He ran a hand across her arm. Her skin was like cream. The anticipation of exploring her bodily treasures was inebriating. How many ways could he violate her? The Hashashin knew he deserved this woman. He had served Janus well. She was a spoil of war, and when he was finished with her, he would pull her from the divan and force her to her knees. She would service him again, the ultimate submission. Then, at the moment of his own climax, he would slit her throat. Gayat Asada, they called it, the ultimate pleasure. Afterward, basking in his glory, he would stand on the balcony and savor the culmination of the Illuminati triumph, a revenge desired by so many for so long. The tunnel grew darker. Langdon descended. After one complete turn into the earth, the light was all but gone. The tunnel leveled out, and Langdon slowed, sensing by the echo of his footfalls that he had just entered a larger chamber. Before him, in the murkiness, he thought he saw glimmers of light, fuzzy reflections in the ambient gleam. He moved forward, reaching out his hand. He found smooth surfaces, chrome and glass. It was a vehicle. He groped the surface, found a door, and opened it. The vehicle's interior dome light flashed on. He stepped back and recognized the black van immediately. Feeling a surge of loathing, he stared a moment. Then he dove in, rooting around in hopes of finding a weapon to replace the one he'd lost in the fountain. He found none. He did, however, find Vittoria's cell phone. It was shattered and useless. The sight of it filled Langdon with fear. He prayed he was not too late. He reached up and turned on the van's headlights. The room around him blazed into existence, harsh shadows in a simple chamber. Langdon guessed the room was once used for horses and ammunition. It was also a dead end. No exit. I came the wrong way. At the end of his rope, Langdon jumped from the van and scanned the walls around him. No doorways, no gates. He thought of the angel over the tunnel entrance and wondered if it had been a coincidence. No! He thought of the killer's words at the fountain. She is in the Church of Illumination, waiting my return. Langdon had come too far to fail now. His heart was pounding. Frustration and hatred were starting to cripple his senses. When he saw blood on the floor, Langdon's first thought was for Vittoria. But as his eyes followed the stains, he realized they were bloody footprints. The strides were long. The splotches of blood were only on the left foot. The Hashashin. Langdon followed the footprints toward the corner of the room, his sprawling shadow growing fainter. He felt more and more puzzled with every step. The bloody prints looked as though they walked directly into the corner of the room and then disappeared. When Langdon arrived in the corner, he couldn't believe his eyes. The granite block in the floor here was not a square like the others. He was looking at another signpost. The block was carved into a perfect pentagram, arranged with the tip pointing into the corner. Ingeniously concealed by overlapping walls, a narrow slit in the stone served as an exit. Langdon slid through. He was in a passage. In front of him were the remains of a wooden barrier that had once been blocking this tunnel. Beyond it, there was light. Langdon was running now. He clambered over the wood and headed for the light. The passage quickly opened into another, larger chamber. Here, a single torch flickered on the wall. Langdon was in a section of the castle that had no electricity, a section no tourists would ever see. The room would have been frightful in daylight, but the torch made it even more gruesome. Il prigione. There were a dozen tiny jail cells. The iron bars on most eroded away. One of the larger cells, however, remained intact. And on the floor, Langdon saw something that almost stopped his heart. Black robes and red sashes on the floor. This is where he held the cardinals. Near the cell was an iron doorway in the wall. The door was ajar, and beyond it, Langdon could see some sort of passage. He ran toward it, but Langdon stopped before he got there. The trail of blood didn't enter the passage. When Langdon saw the words carved over the archway, he knew why. Il passetto. He was stunned. He had heard of this tunnel many times, never knowing where exactly the entrance was. Il passetto, the little passage, was a slender three-quarter-mile tunnel built between Castle Sant'Angelo and the Vatican. It had been used by various popes to escape to safety during sieges of the Vatican, as well as by a few less pious popes to secretly visit mistresses or oversee the torture of their enemies. Nowadays, both ends of the tunnel were supposedly sealed with impenetrable locks, whose keys were kept in some Vatican vault. Langdon suddenly feared he knew how the Illuminati had been moving in and out of the Vatican. He found himself wondering who on the inside had betrayed the church and coughed up the keys. Olivetti? One of the Swiss guards? None of it mattered anymore. The blood on the floor led to the opposite end of the prison. Langdon followed. Here, a rusty gate hung draped with chains. The lock had been removed, and the gate stood ajar. Beyond the gate was a steep ascension of spiral stairs. The floor here was also marked with a pentagramal block. Langdon stared at the block, trembling, wondering if Bernini himself had held the chisel that had shaped these chunks. Overhead, the archway was adorned with a tiny carved cherub. This was it. The trail of blood curved up the stairs. Before ascending, Langdon knew he needed a weapon, any weapon. He found a 4-foot section of iron bar near one of the cells. It had a sharp, splintered end. Although absurdly heavy, it was the best he could do. He hoped the element of surprise, combined with the Hashashin's wound, would be enough to tip the scales in his advantage. Most of all, though, he hoped he was not too late. The staircase's spiral treads were worn and twisted steeply upward. Langdon ascended, listening for sounds. None. As he climbed, the light from the prison area faded away. He ascended into the total darkness, keeping one hand on the wall. Higher. In the blackness, Langdon sensed the ghost of Galileo climbing these very stairs, eager to share his visions of heaven with other men of science and faith. Langdon was still in a state of shock over the location of the lair. The Illuminati meeting hall was in a building owned by the Vatican. No doubt while the Vatican guards were out searching basements and homes of well-known scientists, the Illuminati were meeting here, right under the Vatican's nose. It seemed so perfect. Bernini, as head architect of renovations here, would have had unlimited access to this structure, remodeling it to his own specifications with no questions asked. How many secret entries had Bernini added? How many subtle embellishments pointing the way? The Church of Illumination. Langdon knew he was close. As the stairs began narrowing, Langdon felt the passage closing around him. The shadows of history were whispering in the dark, but he moved on. When he saw the horizontal shaft of light before him, he realized he was standing a few steps beneath a landing, where the glow of torchlight spilled out beneath the threshold of a door in front of him. Silently, he moved up. Langdon had no idea where in the castle he was right now, but he knew he had climbed far enough to be near the peak. He pictured the mammoth angel atop the castle, and suspected it was directly overhead. "Watch over me, angel," he thought, gripping the bar. Then, silently, he reached for the door. On the divan, Vittoria's arms ached. When she had first awoken to find them tied behind her back, she thought she might be able to relax and work her hands free. But time had run out. The beast had returned. Now he was standing over her, his chest bare and powerful, scarred from battles he had endured. His eyes looked like two black slits as he stared down at her body. Vittoria sensed he was imagining the deeds he was about to perform. Slowly, as if to taunt her, the Hashashin removed his soaking belt and dropped it on the floor. Vittoria felt a loathing horror. She closed her eyes. When she opened them again, the Hashashin had produced a switchblade knife. He snapped it open directly in front of her face. Vittoria saw her own terrified reflection in the steel. The Hashashin turned the blade over and ran the back of it across her belly. The icy metal gave her chills. With a contemptuous stare, he slipped the blade below the waistline of her shorts. She inhaled. He moved back and forth, slowly, dangerously, lower. Then he leaned forward, his hot breath whispering in her ear. "This blade cut out your father's eye." Vittoria knew in that instant that she was capable of killing. The Hashashin turned the blade again and began sawing upward through the fabric of her khaki shorts. Suddenly he stopped, looking up. Someone was in the room. "Get away from her," a deep voice growled from the doorway. Vittoria couldn't see who had spoken, but she recognized the voice. "Robert! He's alive!" The Hashashin looked as if he had seen a ghost.
"Mr. Langdon, you must have a guardian angel."
Chapter 108. In the split second it took Langdon to take in his surroundings, he realized he was in a sacred place. The embellishments in the oblong room, though old and faded, were replete with familiar symbology. Pentagram tiles, planet frescoes, doves, pyramids. The Church of Illumination, simple and pure. He had arrived. Directly in front of him, framed in the opening of the balcony, stood the Hashashin. He was bare-chested, standing over Vittoria, who lay bound but very much alive. Langdon felt a wave of relief to see her. For an instant their eyes met, and a torrent of emotions flowed, gratitude, desperation, and regret.
"So we meet yet again," the Hashashin said.
He looked at the bar in Langdon's hand and laughed out loud.
"And this time you come for me with that?"
"Untie her." The Hashashin put the knife to Vittoria's throat.
"I will kill her."
Langdon had no doubt the Hashashin was capable of such an act. He forced a calm into his voice.
"I imagine she would welcome it, considering the alternative."
The Hashashin smiled at the insult.
"You're right. She has much to offer. It would be a waste."
Langdon stepped forward, grasping the rusted bar, and aimed the splintered end directly at the Hashashin. The cut on his hand bit sharply.
"Let her go."
The Hashashin seemed for a moment to be considering it. Exhaling, he dropped his shoulders. It was a clear motion of surrender. And yet at that exact instant the Hashashin's arm seemed to accelerate unexpectedly. There was a blur of dark muscle, and a blade suddenly came tearing through the air toward Langdon's chest. Whether it was instinct or exhaustion that buckled Langdon's knees at that moment, he didn't know. But the knife sailed past his left ear and clattered to the floor behind him. The Hashashin seemed unfazed. He smiled at Langdon, who was kneeling now, holding the metal bar. The killer stepped away from Vittoria and moved toward Langdon like a stalking lion. As Langdon scrambled to his feet, lifting the bar again, his wet turtleneck and pants felt suddenly more restrictive. The Hashashin, half-clothed, seemed to move much faster, the wound on his foot apparently not slowing him at all. Langdon sensed this was a man accustomed to pain. For the first time in his life, Langdon wished he were holding a very big gun. The Hashashin circled slowly, as if enjoying himself, always just out of reach, moving toward the knife on the floor. Langdon cut him off. Then the killer moved back toward Vittoria. Again, Langdon cut him off. "There's still time," Langdon ventured. "Tell me where the canister is. The Vatican will pay more than the Illuminati ever could."
"You are naive."
Langdon jabbed with the bar. The Hashashin dodged. He navigated around a bench, holding the weapon in front of him, trying to corner the Hashashin in the oval room. This damn room has no corners. Oddly, the Hashashin didn't seem interested in attacking or fleeing. He was simply playing Langdon's game, coolly waiting.
Waiting for what?
The killer kept circling, a master at positioning himself. It was like an endless game of chess. The weapon in Langdon's hand was getting heavy, and he suddenly sensed he knew what the Hashashin was waiting for. "He's tiring me out." It was working, too. Langdon was hit by a surge of weariness, the adrenaline alone no longer enough to keep him alert. He knew he had to make a move. The Hashashin seemed to read Langdon's mind, shifting again as if intentionally leading Langdon toward a table in the middle of the room. Langdon could tell there was something on the table, something glinted in the torchlight. A weapon? Langdon kept his eyes focused on the Hashashin and maneuvered himself closer to the table. When the Hashashin cast a long, guileless glance at the table, Langdon tried to fight the obvious bait. But instinct overruled. He stole a glance. The damage was done. It wasn't a weapon at all. The sight momentarily riveted him. On the table lay a rudimentary copper chest, crusted with ancient patina. The chest was a pentagon. The lid lay open. Arranged inside in five padded compartments were five brands. The brands were forged of iron, large embossing tools with stout handles of wood. Langdon had no doubt what they said. Illuminati, earth, air, fire, water. Langdon snapped his head back, fearing the Hashashin would lunge. He didn't. The killer was waiting, almost as if he were refreshed by the game. Langdon fought to recover his focus, locking eyes again with his quarry, thrusting with the pipe. But the image of the box hung in his mind. Although the brands themselves were mesmerizing, artifacts few Illuminati scholars even believed existed, Langdon suddenly realized there had been something else about the box that had ignited a wave of foreboding within. As the Hashashin maneuvered again, Langdon stole another glance downward. My God! In the chest, the five brands sat in compartments around the outer edge, but in the center, there was another compartment. This partition was empty, but it clearly was intended to hold another brand, a brand much larger than the others, and perfectly square.